Ghosts, cryptids, murder, conspiracies, beer, what, the ale.
Hello, friends.
Hello, hello.
Welcome to our December keg. I'm Alana Ray.
And I'm Mama J.
And before we get into it, Mama, what are you drinking this week? And do you have any What the Ale moments?
I'm drinking a Goose Island Bourbon Country Stout. And yeah, my What the Ale is probably that I'm on an annual trip that I do with my dad to this little cabin that we always go to. And there's no snow. And I, you know, usually when we come, there's at least some snow on the ground. And I'm bummed because this is usually the one time a year that I get to see snow.
Oh, well, that
You have lots of snow, though.
Huh?
You probably have lots of snow, though.
Oh, we have no snow.
Oh, really?
No snow. It snowed and then it melted. And then we have been like in freezing ranges. So like water's been freezing on the street, but no snow. So. But I'm
Okay.
fine with that because, again, like I said, I have my winter road trip this weekend, so I do not want snow while
Yeah.
happening. So, yeah.
What about you? Drinking anything or any with you?
Yeah, I'm having a seltzer, actually. It's like a V, it's called VV, but it's like a little passion fruit seltzer thing because I wasn't feeling a beer today.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, no, it's good though. I've never really had this brand, so I was like, I'll try it. Yeah, let me think what the yell moments. Kind of a silly one is I have a sty on my eye and I just think that's the worst. Like I woke up this morning
Oh.
and like I could barely open my eye and was like, what the heck is going on? And there's definitely a sty here, so gonna
Oh,
have
no.
to do some like compresses on my eyeball and things. But it just like it's such a dumb issue, but I'm like, really?
Well, that sucks.
Yeah. So, but it's okay. I feel like I was in need of like some good like face mask and self-care time. So that's just gonna force me to do it, I guess. So
Yeah.
we'll see. But I guess, are you ready to get into our topic?
Yeah.
Okay, friends. So we decided to do a real doozy of a case. So we're just going to give some background and then get into it. But for folks who don't know, in the 80s in California, specifically Southern California, but a little bit in the Bay Area as well, there was a serial killer terrorizing folks, and it started out in SoCal, but went all the way up to the Bay Area, like I said. So if you don't know who I'm talking about, we're going to cover the Night Stalker or the Walk-In Killer. But everyone knows him as the Night Stalker. So I feel like, but he was the Walk-In Killer before they gave him that name. So I'm just going to stress a lot of this info did come from the Netflix documentary. I did do some fact checking on the internet, and then I also watched another documentary. So I'm really excited to not have to ever talk about this again.
It's a big case.
It's a huge case. No, I'll probably talk about it again, but it's just, it is a massive case. Lots of information. Something that was really unique about the Night Stalker was that there was really no specific MO. The killer used lots of different methods of, killing and weapons and, bondage or, whatever. He also sought out a variety of victims, and there was no clear motive for any of it. So the Night Stalker was really scary because, it took a while to even connect the crimes, let alone connect, or figure out like a pattern with him.
Yeah, because you're usually looking for like a specific victim type or, things victims have in common. And these, I mean, even the age range is insane.
Yeah, he really was just killing anyone and everything. So, I want to stress in the documentary, so there are two key like detectives who really brought the whole thing together. So I'm going to give a little background on both of them. And we're going to kind of cover the timeline that they explained and how they solved the case. Just because it, yes, like some stuff happened before, where we start and that type of thing, but this timeline just made the most sense for putting together how he was caught. So the first was Gil Carrillo. He, was from East LA, born in like a Mexican immigrant family. He was, when he was young, like running the streets and like kind of getting in a bad way. And he luckily got like recruited from the or recruited by the army. So like when he went into the service, he like did great and like was really successful, got married, went to college, and then he decided to start working for the LAPD. And then after 9 years, which is actually pretty quick apparently in the LAPD, he got assigned to robbery homicide with the sheriff's office, which is really quick, I guess, if you're a young gun. So in 1981, he was assigned to robbery homicide where he met Frank Salerno. And if you are a LA crime person, you probably know who Frank Salerno is. He's kind of a legend in LA. He was the guy they called for big crimes. He's best known for taking down the Hillside Strangler, but also the Night Stalker. So,
Yeah,
he's taken down some
two
big
big
guys.
ones.
Robbery homicide in general at the time was called the Bulldogs. Like, people talk about how they were just kind of rough. They like never let go of a case. Like, they would solve things like 20 years later. Like, these guys were just like really dedicated, I guess. So yeah, him and Gil become partners when Gil is transferred to robbery homicide, which is very exciting. And something that they all like wanted to stress was at the time in LA County, there's a lot of jurisdictions between the sheriff, the LAPD, and like the smaller cities like Glendale Police or whoever. And so there were at least 1,000 murders a year that like they were looking at. And the thing that kind of sucks is that some jurisdictions were not talking to each other, or there were jurisdictional issues. And that comes up with this case a lot, with like pieces of evidence not being shared or things coming up later that could have been solved or things like that. So you will see that. But like I said, we're gonna kind of follow the timeline the investigators took, while, or like the timeline that happened for the investigators, and then we'll kind of like give some context for like the killer and like other stuff like that. So I guess,
All
Mama,
right.
want to start with our first few cases?
Yeah. Well, and I want to give a warning for, all of the things, because there is a lot of violence and sexual assault and all the things. So, before I give the details of these first few, I just want to put that out there.
Yes. Is a really brutal killer, so like no worries if you need to like step away or not listen to this.
Yeah. So June 1984, Jenny Vinkow, who is 79, she was found with her throat slashed and stabbed repeatedly. The suspect had robbed her home in Glassell Park in Los Angeles. And then the next two were Mary and Christina Caldwell, who were 70 and 58 years old. And these two sisters were killed in San Francisco in 1984, and they were also stabbed and assaulted.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, just, yeah. So anyways, but in different areas that, but all different kinds of victims. And then on March 17th, 1985, in Rosemead, detectives were called to a scene. And when they got there, the garage door was open, and there was some blood spatter in the condo. And they found Dale Akasaki, who was 34 years old, and she was found shot in her forehead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it seemed obvious to them that she had like looked over the counter. Maybe she heard something, but she had looked over the counter But that's where the intruder was like hiding on the other side of the counter and shot her there. So I
Wow.
guess the way her body was or the crime scene was, they could tell that she had like looked over to see him.
Yeah, I mean, even like that's super scary. Like, if she knew he was in the condo, right? And
Yeah.
like that's just such a like fucked up cat and mouse thing.
Well, and I mean, I think all of us have heard a noise and like kind of like looked through our house or like walked, opened a door and looked into a room because we heard something fall or we heard, but I mean, so she is, I just feel like we all have the experience of doing that. So for her to be shot while she's leaning over the counter is just really sad. She probably had no idea that was coming.
Right, yeah.
And then her roommate, Maria Hernandez, who was 20, she had come home and the suspect was standing outside of their garage and he shot her. She fell to the ground,
Oh,
but
wow.
luckily the bullet deflected off of her keys. So she was able to get up and run down the alley for help. And then Maria heard another gunshot and was worried about Dale. So she went around to the front of the condo and the killer walked out the door.
Oh,
And they
God.
kind of surprised each other. Like he wasn't expecting her to be there, or maybe he was expecting she was already dead. But girl, she just threw her hands up and said, "You've already shot me once. You really gonna do it again?" And the killer walked away. And I like, that's pretty
Crazy.
ballsy to be like, dude, really? Are we gonna do this? But good for her because it worked and he just walked away.
Yeah, I mean, that's just crazy to me. Like, she ballsy. Ballsy is the correct
Yeah. And then, this is where, some of these cases you realize it's a small world.
word.
Because Gil grew up three doors down from Maria.
Oh,
And
wow.
so it was immediately personal for him.
Wow, that's crazy. I
Yeah.
mean, you imagine like your childhood friend like is someone that you're helping. Like, I think
Yeah.
a lot. Like, if I like came into clinic one day and like my friend was like one of my patients, I'd be like,
Yeah.
which I know is like not how that works, but
But I do think, if it feels more personal to them, maybe they're more motivated. Although with this case, there was so much bloodshed that I'm sure they were already very motivated, because they just wanted to stop this guy. And I'm sure there was pressure from the media and everything. But the police realized that the killer really liked to see the fear in the faces of his victims. So Maria worked with an artist to make a suspect sketch. And another detective found a sketch that was done from another crime scene that looked kind of similar. And this was from an attempted kidnapping in Pico Rivera.
wow. And we're gonna get more into the kidnappings too, because those are crazy. So immediately after the Okazaki and Hernandez shooting and killing, in Monterey Park, which is about a mile away, Cy Leon Yu, who was 30 years old, was driving down the street. They said she had like just parked her car, but was like sitting in the car maybe, so maybe not driving. But she was stopped, or the killer came and pulled her out of her car, and shot her. And the gun was of the same caliber as from the other crime, so it was a 22 caliber gun. And something that I think is interesting is like you'll kind of see that like if he didn't get something he wanted, like if he didn't kill both people or he didn't get to assault someone or something, he would just like go and do whatever it was again. Which again is why he's so scary.
He just seems really impulsive.
Yeah, exactly. But about 10 days later, on March 27th of 85, in Whittier County, Vincent and Maxine Cesara, who were 64 and 44 respectively, were killed. When investigators arrived, they found that the killer had stepped on a 5 gallon tub, or like a 5 gallon bucket, and crept in through a window. Vincent was like sleeping on the couch and was just shot in the head, like while he was sleeping on the couch. And then Maxine was found raped and murdered. And really just fucked up wise, the killer took her eyes out before fleeing. Which I don't, like, there's really no explanation for that. Like, there's no reason,
Yeah. It's
anything for
very
that.
disturbing, though.
It was the same caliber gun as the other two killings, and they also found a size 11 to 12 shoe print that was kind of unique for the time. And they did some digging and they found it was an Avia shoe. It was an aerobic shoe, size 11 and a half. And after some digging, they found that only one pair of these shoes had actually been shipped to Los Angeles. So they
Wow.
couldn't figure out who bought the shoes, but they knew that only one person had these shoes if they got them
Wow.
in LA.
Well, that seems like a really big clue then.
So it's a huge clue, which they kept a secret from the media and everybody, which is important for later. And so obviously, these murders are really scary, but something else that was really scary that was happening in LA was there was a string of child abductions at the time of both male and female children. The suspect would kidnap them, assault them, and then return to the parents. Normally, he would like drop them at a gas station and tell them to call the police or just like abandon them
Wow.
somewhere else. Sadly, robbery, homicide, and sex crimes are handled by different departments and jurisdictions, so they didn't communicate with each other. So initially, Gil was like putting it together. He's like, I think these are connected. Like, he's like, the way this killer is, the way things are going, I do think these are connected. And people like
Yeah.
didn't believe him because a suspect that does like multiple types of crimes or different like MOs is really rare.
Yeah.
So they thought he was a young
But
politician.
just the age thing, you feel like most people target a person of a certain age and a lot of times it's just women or it's just men, so to have male and female and kids and people in their 70s, I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's a real spread. And so people, of course, didn't believe him and they thought he was trying to make a name for himself with these cases, but we're going to find that they are connected
Yeah.
soon.
All right. Well, and a 6-year-old girl was one of these kidnapping victims. She was awoken in the middle of the night by a man that had come through her window. And she believed that he looked like one of her family members, so she trusted him. And then in the car, he had her open the glove box and there was a gun in there. And he was like, just so you know, it's there. And he also forced her to perform sexual acts on him. At that point, he had her get into a zipped up duffel bag and he brought her into like a dingy, dirty home. And there were like takeout containers and trash everywhere. And he assaulted her for several hours.
Oh my
And
gosh.
she tried to escape by asking to go to the bathroom, but he wouldn't stop. And he like held her over the sink.
Oh gosh. Ew.
And then she explained that he almost looked sad or sorry for what that he was doing and that he was doing that to her. But she was put back in the duffel bag and he dropped her off at a payphone and told her to call the police.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And like you said, most of the child cases were similar to this account where he would assault them and then like drop them somewhere so they could be returned to their parents. But I mean, still the trauma that these kids went to is horrific.
Yeah, and like it is interesting, like the idea that he looked sad or sorry, where it's like, well, then don't do it. Like, I don't know.
Well, and I mean, because we'll see later, he doesn't show much remorse. So it's interesting that during, at least some of these accounts, people describe him that way because he doesn't show that later.
Yeah, that's true.
And then finally, there was a lead. A man named Arturo Robles was found following women in kind of a creepy way. And he was brought in for questioning, and detectives said that he had an answer for everything. Maria Hernandez was shown a lineup with him in it. And she said it could be him, but maybe not 100% sure. And at his apartment, there were magazines of women strewn about, and underwear with the crotch cut out.
That's uncomfortable. Why? I don't okay.
And then there was a lineup, but no one could pick him out, with like 100% certainty, so they let him go.
That is interesting. I mean, I think I remember this guy, and I think they were like, he's creepy, he's weird, but he's not the one we're looking for. From the research, like he just wasn't He didn't totally fit, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next couple of cases start in May, actually. So we're going down a little bit, but May 14th of 85, there was another murder in Monterey Park. So William and Lillian Doy were found murdered. William was 65, Lillian was 56. What am I saying? So Lillian was raped and shot, and William had been shot as well. But before, he, or I guess he was able to call 911 before succumbing to his injuries. And so luckily the police were on scene pretty quickly. And they found when they arrived, Lillian had already passed, but she was bound with thumb cuffs, which is super unique, apparently not common at all. Frank had said that it was the only case in his entire career where someone used thumb cuffs. So not common at all. And then at that crime scene, another detective, or another officer from Montebello Police found a footprint from a child abduction that actually was an exact match for the Avia shoe print from the murder scenes. So finally, Gil was like, see, this is the link. We know that it's the same person because, like, it's only one pair of shoes. But again, it was still going to take convincing. I think people were like, not a fan of just like, again, how scary this guy is, right? Like, he just was not a typical perpetrator, unfortunately. So, yeah.
Well, and I know most of the cases we've talked about so far were, sexual assaults and then, shootings, but this is where, there are some other brutal killings with different means. So, there was a string of attacks starting on June 28th, 1985. Patty Elaine Higgins, 32, was attacked in Arcadia, and he cut her throat and then like stabbed her in that wound, which is, I don't know, it's something.
I hate everything about that. No, thank you.
And then a few days later, on July 2nd, there was another attack in Arcadia where Mary Cannon, 75, also had her throat slit.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later, there was another case in Sierra Madre, and it was a 16-year-old Whitney Bennett who was brutally beaten with a tire iron in her home. And she survived, but she had 42 inches of lacerations and skull fractures, and
Oh.
she only remembered going to bed before the attack, so she was probably awoken with a strike from the tire iron.
Oh my God.
And on the crime scene, they found the Avia shoe print on her comforter in her bedroom, so she was able, her case was able to be tied to the other crimes.
That's just like I just wonder because it's really rare that like serial killers change it up, right? So I just wonder like is it like of opportunity? Like what's around? Like I have a lot of questions.
And then the very next day there was another attempted murder. So again, he was like just driven to kill. It just he just had that impulse because it was like he was not taking time in between. He wasn't really planning. He was like just taking any opportunity. So the next day on July 6th of 85, there was an attempted murder, and this was Lorraine Rodriguez, and she heard a loud noise and she called out for her husband, but pretty quickly she realized that it was not her husband. And John, her actual husband, got his gun and walked around the house. A window that they knew was closed before they went to bed was wide open, and they saw footprints in the dirt under the window, and they called the police. And John was a cop, and he preserved the prints with the shoebox.
Oh my
And
gosh.
of course, the footprints matched the Avia shoe.
How lucky that he didn't come in the house or he didn't, because I mean, like, was he like what I'm wondering was he scared of the noise? Like, what, like, why didn't he? Thank goodness we don't want more murder, but
Well, I wonder if maybe he realized that they, were awake and that it wouldn't be as easy, and that they're, so maybe Yeah, maybe that turned him off, or I don't know if he knew that John was a cop or something.
Right.
But yeah.
That's super crazy. But again,
Yeah.
like really glad they survived. We're bringing it back to May, and the only reason for this is because at this point, some of the jurisdictions did start talking to each other and putting connections based on evidence that they had. And so in May 29th in Monrovia, there was a pair of elderly sisters who were attacked in their home and really tragically weren't found until 2 days later. So Mabel Bell, who was 83, was found killed and bound with electrical tape, and she was spread eagle on her bed.
Wow.
And then her sister Florence Lang, who was 80, was also found attacked and bound and clinging to life. Luckily, she did survive.
Wow.
And there was an alarm clock on the floor in the house that had a partial shoe print that matched the Avia shoe. And something just so fucked up is they found that the killer actually remained in the house and had a snack after the attack. And
Oh
this
my
is where
gosh.
we get into some of the satanic shit because a pentagram was drawn on the victim's leg and on the wall in lipstick. And this was the first crime scene that we know of where this had been seen. So super freaky.
Yeah.
Around this time, there was also an attempted kidnapping in Eagle Rock where a victim fought the suspect off. And he drove off in a Toyota that was stopped for a traffic violation. I think he was just driving kind of erratically. It wasn't anything like terrible, I guess. But when pulled over, the suspect had no ID. And while he was waiting for the citation from the cop, the cop's radio went off saying there was an attempted kidnapping, and it described the car. And so he drew a pentagram on the hood of the car and ran off. And so they found A, that the car had been stolen, and so and B, obviously this was the guy that kidnapped, so they didn't catch him, but they did impound the car at the cops' impound lot. So,
And
you
it's so sad because if they had caught him right then, it would have saved a lot of people.
Yeah, it is really sad. Like I said, there's a few times where they almost had him, and it's just like, oh my gosh, like how did they
Yeah. Well, they just didn't even realize it was him,
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's not their fault, but
Yeah, but you wish they would have known.
yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, in Monterey Park on 7/7/85, Joyce Nelson, 60, was killed. She fought back and he like beat her and left a shoe print on her face.
Oh my gosh.
And then he went to another house where Sophia Dickman was raped and robbed. She was 63 years old. Like she was handcuffed to the bed and the man had told her not to look at him. It's suspected that he came in through the cat door and she pulled the bed to the window and called to her neighbor for help. And then on July 9th of 85, they learned that the stolen car was not processed by the LAPD. It had been stored outside, so pretty much all evidence was gone, which is a pretty big fuck up. Like, they had a car that he was in and then it never was processed. So, but there was a small case with a card for a dentist in Chinatown, and the suspect was in on 7/3 under the name Richard Mena, and they were able to get X-rays from the dentist and found that he had an impacted tooth. So,
Oh.
two police officers were planted in the waiting room, hoping that he would return. And they then put an alarm in the office and pulled the officers. The day that the alarm was put in, apparently Richard came in, but the alarm malfunctioned and didn't alert police.
Oh my gosh, that sucks. Like
Yeah.
technology just failing us again.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on 7/20 of 85, Max and Nielding and Layla, they were husband and wife, and they were 68 and 66, and they were found in Glendale. The family went to check on them, and the pool gate and the back door was open,
Oh my
and
goodness.
they were found killed in their bedroom. They both had been shot with a 22 caliber pistol, and it was proven to be the same gun as in earlier cases.
That's so sad. I mean, just
Yeah.
like the family discovering them. I mean, which is the case in a lot of these cases, but it's so sad.
Yeah. And then that day in Sun Valley, there was another murder. And this killer had entered from a sliding glass door. They found an Avia footprint on the porch. And 32-year-old Chainarong Covenant was shot in the head with a 22 caliber gun, and some kid Covenant, 29, was assaulted, and their 8-year-old son was also assaulted. And the killer also took some items from the home. They were able to take a composite sketch from some kid, and it was similar to the Okazaki case. So, they now had two different people describing him in the same way.
So moving on to August. So on August 6th of 85 in Northridge, Chris and Virginia Peterson were both shot in the head. And they both survived, which is the crazy thing to me.
Wow.
And despite being shot in the head, Chris like chased him out of the house and actually was like ready to take him down, but the killer escaped.
Oh my gosh.
And the thing that is different about this case is that the killer used a 25 caliber gun, but they used these shell casings with red primer in them. And apparently these bullets were not made anymore, like they were really old. And so they knew that this could be a link to other cases as well.
Okay.
And then on August 8th of 85 in Diamond Bar, Elias Abawath, who was 35 years old, was shot in bed. And it was in the same caliber. It was the same caliber gun and the same bullets as in the Peterson case. His wife had also been sexually assaulted. The wife did survive, but obviously, like the husband did not. And the killer, told him not to look at him, and she swore to God she wouldn't. And he said, "No, don't swear to God, swear to Satan."
Oh my gosh.
Again, getting into his like fucked up satanic stuff again. Okay, so now moving all the way up to San Francisco again. On August 18th of 1985, Peter Pan and his wife Barbara were attacked. And Peter was 66. He was shot in his bed. His wife was raped and shot, but she was still alive. And this just like is so disgusting. But the killer ate food in the house and then made himself vomit in the kitchen. He carved satanic things in the wall, including things like Jack the Ripper and other things. And then he masturbated in the living room. And so the SFPD, were kind of investigating, and the gun was a match for the murders in LA. And so investigators from LA headed to San Francisco. Gil and Frank recorded a video to brief various police departments on the killer so that they knew what evidence to look for or what things could tie him to them. And so
Yeah.
they briefed the police on the case as well. So yeah, super, super fun and exciting.
Well, and again, in the 80s, he had no idea about DNA technology, that if they hadn't caught him sooner, that would have caught him eventually if
Yeah.
they had vomit and semen from him. So,
Well, and I think, I mean, there was probably DNA on all of these crime scenes. Just
yeah.
seems like he was doing all sorts of stuff. I mean,
Yeah. I'm sure there was. So yeah, but yeah, back then that was not a thing. So luckily they found him through other means.
yeah.
So throughout the entire case, there was a media frenzy, and many people were terrified across to, California. And I remember I shared when we talked about Cecil Hotel and mentioned him, that my mom was one of those that was like, during that time, was very diligent about checking windows and doors, and she would like look under her car to make sure nobody was like hiding under there and gonna grab her. So,
Yeah.
as a kid, I remember how freaked out people were. So detectives were getting tips left and right, but there were no viable leads, and they were keeping the Avia shoe clue secret so that they could continue following those leads and not like tip off the suspect.
Right.
And they even had to do exclusive interviews for the media to keep this a secret. And like I said, people were just so scared that they were starting to buy more guns and ammo, and they were amping up their security in their homes. People were taking self-defense classes. I mean,
Oh.
people were really afraid.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then, as you said, Gil and Frank were making videos for all the jurisdictions with the info about the killer, so everybody was kind of on the same page, and hopefully would be more effective in catching the killer. And the mayor of San Francisco, Dianne Feinstein, wanted to catch the killer, so she held a press conference, and the mayor's office issued a $10,000 reward for the murder, or leads that would lead to catching the killer. But unfortunately, she talked about the evidence and warned citizens to stay safe. And the big problem, though, was that she shared the shoe information and the firearms evidence, and that was what the cops wanted to keep quiet, so that the perpetrator wouldn't change those things. So she really made a mistake there. So I'm sure the police were not happy with her. And then the LA sheriff held a press conference discussing the evidence and being upset that some of the info shared could jeopardize the case. So they definitely called her out for that.
Which I think is like kind of funny. Like that the LAPD was like, we're going to say we're pissed off about this.
Yeah. Well, and I don't blame them. I mean, she could have really screwed that up, if the killer changed those things and it made it harder to tie him to everything.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of where we get close to catching the killer. So on August 24th of 85 in Mission Viejo, there was another attack. This proved that the killer was back in Southern California. So he just went on vacation in San Francisco, I guess. I don't know. But Bill Carnes was 29 years old and he was shot in the head but still alive. Sadly, his girlfriend was attacked and raped in the car, and the killer said to her that he was the Night Stalker. So clearly, liking the infamy that was coming with being, this killer. James Romero was a neighbor of theirs, and he saw a car that drove by really slow and like kind of creepily. And then he saw it leaving, and he remembered a partial plate and a description of the car. So he gave that to the police, and they were able to match it to a car that had been stolen from Chinatown, which we know the killer steal cars. And they actually ended up finding the car and were able to get a fingerprint from the rear view mirror. But again, this is before computers and technology. AFIS was brand new, so they had to manually match fingerprints, and it was going to take forever. But then they actually, pretty soon after, received a tip from a girl who believed that her father was friends with a man, or who believed her father was friends with a man who could be the Night Stalker, and this man was going by the name Rick. Rick had confessed to her father that he killed a couple in San Francisco. Rick had also given her father a gun, which he then took to Tijuana. They actually were able to recover the gun, and it matched the ballistics of some of the crime scenes. And then they found a radio when they were in Tijuana that belonged to one of the victims. So they were actually able to prove that this was a valid lead.
And in San Francisco, there was also an informant named Earl Gregg, and he gave police a bracelet that could be linked to the case. He got it from his wife's mother and said that her boyfriend Armando Rodriguez had given it to her. Armando got the bracelet from his friend from El Paso, Rick. And investigators found Armando and confronted him about it. And he was a little defensive, so the detectives put some pressure on him. And I don't agree with this, but they did rough him up a little bit. But he ended up giving them the name Richard Ramirez. And
Wow.
this is the first time we hear that name.
I mean, I'm glad we got it, you know?
So Richard Ramirez was from El Paso, Texas. He was born to a blue-collar Mexican family and was the youngest of five kids. From a young age, he had a lot of bad influences. His father, I mean, and I really want to stress, when you hear these things, you're going to feel sorry for him, but you can kind of see that, they created a monster a little bit. So his father would tie him to a cross in the cemetery and leave him there overnight when he misbehaved,
Oh my gosh.
which I can't even imagine being a kid and being left hung on a cross in the cemetery overnight.
Yeah.
His father would also beat him with a belt when he would misbehave. And then his uncle Mike served in Vietnam and would brag to Richard about the atrocities that he committed while he was there,
Oh my God.
which just is really fucked up. And most people go to war and have PTSD, like processing all the things they saw or they had to do. And this motherfucker's bragging about it, which just kills me.
Yeah.
So he showed Richard photos of women that he had raped and beheaded.
Oh my God.
And when he was 13, his uncle shot and killed his wife in front of Richard.
Oh my gosh. That's not good.
Yeah. And he had shot her in the face, similarly to how Richard would shoot some of his victims. And then the uncle was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And after serving a lighter sentence, he came back into Richard's life. And then Richard was like a petty thief and a drug user as well. And he began sleeping in cemeteries, which, again, I like that was a thing his parents did for punishment. Like, I could see how maybe there is like some comfort that he was able to find there because it was familiar, but still very creepy and weird.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, and then at 14, he dropped out of school and he was like starting to get in trouble with the law. And witnesses always mentioned throughout that the killer was tall and skinny and had rotted teeth and dirty hair and smelled bad. And that was pretty good fit for him. So,
Yeah, Richard needed that dentist needed to do a lot for Richard.
yeah.
I mean, and other things, but
Yeah.
yeah, so on August 30th, detectives in LA are informed of the name Richard Ramirez from San Francisco. They had, like, I think they said they had five Richard Ramirezes in the system in LA, and they finally matched the print to a Richard Ramirez who was booked for petty theft about a year ago. But, like, on his record, he had nothing scarier than petty theft.
Yeah.
And the informant in San Francisco, Armando, did confirm that based on the photo that that was Rick or the person that they were looking
Yeah.
for. So they immediately released the name and photo to the press. It was printed on every newspaper, shown on every major news outlet. I mean, it was everywhere. People knew Richard liked to use the Greyhound bus, and he actually had a locker at the station, so they posted cops at the Greyhound station to, hopefully capture him, because they figured if he fleed, he would go to the Greyhound station. And kind of ironically, Richard was in Arizona visiting his brother at the time. So he returned from Arizona and walked in the station and noticed the officers. And they even said, they were like, we were looking for him to come into the station to leave LA. So they weren't looking for him. So he, made the officers, he didn't know they were for him. So he, popped up and flipped out of the station, and he went into a liquor store where he then saw his booking photo on every newspaper.
Yeah.
Knowing he was made, he hopped onto a bus and the passenger started to recognize him. One passenger got off the bus at the next stop, went into a phone booth, and called the police. That passenger de then told a truck that came up behind the bus to follow the bus. And so,
Wow, that was smart thinking.
exactly. And then, so at the next stop, Richard got off the bus. He ran across the freeway and all over town. He basically, I think they said it was like 8 miles if he could have made it. He just had to go 8 miles to get to his brother's house or his cousin's house or something. So
Wow.
I think that's where he was heading. And he tried to steal a car from a man and they wrestled, so he ran away. So then he ran across the street and threatened to kill Angelina De La Torre if she didn't give him the keys to her car. But her husband Manuel was like, oh no, sir, and grabbed a metal stick from the gate and then hit him in the head. And
Wow, good for him.
took him down the street. At that time, people were saying, like, there's the killer, there's the killer. So neighbors were running out of the street and chasing him down, surrounding him, and began beating him. He knew the mob would kill him if the police didn't show up, and he even said something like, Like when the cops showed up, he was like, "Thank God you guys got here."
Yeah.
So the police, showed up, they cuffed Richard and put him in the car. He was like sticking his tongue out at people from the car and, all the things. And they were like trying to question him, like, "What's your name?" and whatever. And he was just like, "It's me. Like, I'm the one you're looking for."
Yeah.
And so at that point, it was over. And you know what? Good for these people beating on him, because
Yeah.
he deserved an ass kicking.
No, I know I said it before, when we did the Cecil, but like, yeah, he definitely deserved an ass whooping. So I'm glad he got it. So they ended up booking Ramirez and went into an investigation room. And I guess he invoked like his Fifth Amendment right, so he wasn't talking. And at some point, he put his head on the table and began breathing heavily, almost hyperventilating. And
Interesting.
all around the station, I mean, because everybody knew this case, so all around the station, people were gathered, and it was a safety concern when they had to transport him to the county jail, because they didn't know what the mob was gonna do,
Yeah, I mean, I think also I'm sure there were probably threats, or there were people like, "I'm gonna get him when he comes out,"
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I don't blame them for feeling that way.
No, not
So
at all.
after the arrest, they set up a lineup and asked that 6-year-old victim to identify who hurt her. And immediately she knew it was Richard.
That's so sad.
And then they checked the locker at the Greyhound station that he had, and they found a mountain of evidence linking him to the crimes. So the trial itself was a whole to-do because Richard's family retained Daniel and Arturo Hernandez for his defense, and he had turned down the public defender, and he was assigned and even hired Gallegos as his attorney for a minute in exchange for a book deal.
Oh my God.
And people didn't think the team was qualified to represent him because they had never had a case of that magnitude. And then, of course, the things people remember about the trial is during his arraignment, he drew a pentagram on his hand and flashed it to the media and said, "Hail Satan." So I know a lot of people, you've probably seen the photo of him or the video of him doing that. Something a lot of people report was that just being in the room with him, there was a dark and evil presence. And it would be 3 years before he would be on trial. But like he really tried to play it up like he was a rock star or something. He got his teeth fixed and he grew out his hair and he wore designer suits and sunglasses in court. So he was trying to be like the superstar. And then the prosecution and the detectives agreed to dismiss the child molestation cases because they just didn't want the kids to have to testify and cause them more trauma, which when they had him for so many other things, to me, it makes sense to just not have that included if it'll save the kids some trauma and grief.
I mean, still super duper sad.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, because there were so many abduction cases, like they even on that could have gotten him in for life. So I think they were just like, "We're already gonna get him in for life." Like, there's no like, there's
Yeah.
it. But formally, Richard was charged with 14 murders, 19 burglaries, 7 rapes, and other charges like, grand theft auto and things. And the prosecution made it clear that they were seeking the death penalty.
When 14 murders, like, and all of that in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, it was what, like 10 months, they said, something like
Yeah.
really quick.
I mean, that's a lot in a short time.
Yeah, well, and just the sheer number of attacks, because there were a lot of attacks outside of the murders where people survived.
Yeah.
Well, so there was a lot of, just a lot of bad vibes, man. Like,
Yeah.
not a good guy. So at one point, Richard, I guess, was caught on tape or something asking a friend to bring a gun into the court so he could kill the prosecution. So they obviously shackled him and upped security at this time.
Well, that would be scary if you're the prosecutor in the case, like learning that that was a plan.
Yeah, I mean, that's
Yeah.
terrifying. A lot
Yeah,
of
you'd be scared to go to work.
A lot of the detectives and things noted that this was like one of the few cases where they actually like slept with a gun or, they were scared for their lives, being a part of this
Yeah.
case. So yeah, it wasn't just, the victims, obviously, like everyone was really affected by this. So then one morning, a juror did not make it to court. They didn't know why, they had no explanation, and they actually found her dead, in her home. It was a murder. And people started spreading rumors that Richard Ramirez had orchestrated this. Actually, really tragically, she was killed in a domestic violence incident by her husband. And I think that's something that I think was overshadowed, obviously, by the case. Like, this woman was just like
Yeah.
brutally murdered by her husband.
Wow. That's so sad.
Yeah, but luckily, it didn't seem to affect. I mean, the jurors were obviously very sad and freaked out by this, but they were able to substitute in an alternate juror and continue with the trial. And then this is just something I find super fucked up. Ramirez had a ton of groupies who would
Yeah.
dress in black and draw pentagrams on themselves and like would write letters to him and send him nude pictures. And I mean, it was so gross. They would like blame society for what happened to him.
Yeah.
Would ask him if they thought he, was guilty or if they were scared of him. And they would say things like they knew he was a good person inside because they met him or, whatever. But like, you're
Wow.
meeting him at his murder trial while he's shackled. Like, if he broke into your apartment and like killed you, like, and I'm not.
Well, and it just seems so disrespectful to the victims in this case to like act like he's a rock star.
Yeah.
You know, it just kills me that he had groupies because I mean, I just can't imagine being a family member and seeing these women like throwing themselves at him. It's so creepy.
Yeah, it just is so disgusting to me. I'm sorry if you're one of those women. I don't understand it. I'm sorry, I never
It's
will.
just disrespectful to the families.
Yeah. Specifically, one of these groupies was Doreen Leoy. She was a standout for Richard. She would write him and she would claim that she would take his or take her life if he was executed and like all of this crazy shit. So he had a little girlfriend. And in the end, he was found guilty on all 43 counts of murder, assault, etc., and was sentenced to death in the gas chamber. After he said, big deal, death always went with the territory. I'll see you in Disneyland, which is the famous
Wow.
quote that I think everyone has heard. But yeah, he did not give a shit.
Yeah. Well, after the sentencing, he was transported to San Quentin in the Bay Area. And on 10/3/96, Doreen married Ramirez in prison.
Wow.
Was it Doreen or Darlene?
It's Doreen.
Okay. I was like, I want to make sure I get that right. Okay. And then in 2009, the San Francisco police linked him to the death of a small child, and Doreen divorced him after that.
Huh. Like that's what did it for her, I
I
guess.
was gonna say, with all the other atrocities, that was the one thing she just couldn't tolerate. And then he never showed any signs of remorse or regret, which again, I know I said it earlier, but like the, kids said that he seemed to have remorse, although, it didn't stop him from assaulting her. But yeah, he never showed signs of that after he was caught. And investigators really do believe he would have never stopped if he had not been caught,
Right.
which, again, he just seems so impulsive. And like, I mean, these were day after day after day. It wasn't like he was taking time to process what he was doing. He was just in the mode of doing and doing and doing. So I agree that he probably would not have stopped. And then, since this all happened, Ramirez has been linked to several murders across California, but, other murders. And so we really don't know what his total body count is, but it's high. And then on June 7th, 2013, Ramirez died from B-cell lymphoma at the age of 53. And apparently this is one of the worst forms of cancer. And I know that you had shared this during the Cecil episode, but this form of cancer turns you highlight or green, which I guess is a normal side effect. I'm not sure if it's of the cancer or of the treatment, but Yeah, so he was green at the time of his death.
I think it's the cancer because it messes with your blood cells. So I think your body's normal color because of the way the blood cells are
Yeah.
affected. But yeah, I'm glad he got really brutal cancer. Like if it wasn't going to be death.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think having a terrible cancer and dying of that is probably worse than, if he had been killed by the state. So, yeah, I hope it was painful and that he suffered because he deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, no, Richard Ramirez was a fucking terrible human.
Yeah.
Glad he is no longer with us. And I'm glad he died young. I mean, I think all the drugs he did honestly got him. So
Yeah. Well, and I know obviously if you listen to the Cecil episode, you know that during many of these crimes he was staying at the Cecil. So
yeah.
yeah. But yeah, just really, really tragic that you have to wonder what makes somebody do all these kind of things. And but yeah, I really do feel like he got what he deserved. He got the ass kicking he deserved, and then he got the worst cancer. So it's pretty
Yeah,
bad.
I feel like it's pretty rare where like the citizens get to like take out their frustration on somebody, and
Yeah.
that's like my favorite part of this whole case is that he was
Yeah.
like down by the community.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, friends, thanks for sticking with us. Please self-care. I know that was a very heavy one.
Yeah.
Do what you gotta do, but I guess outside of that, you can listen, keep listening to our show, like subscribe, rate 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. We have a Patreon you can follow, where we do bonus episodes. We have our sorry, our Instagram, which is What the L Pod, where you can just check in and see like what we're up to. And then lastly, we do have an email account, which is whatthelpod@gmail.com, where you can reach out to us and we could talk, or you could give us topic ideas or anything like that. And I guess outside of that, I just want to say I appreciate you, Mama.
I appreciate you too.
And we appreciate you, friends. Bye.
Bye.